third case for argument this morning is in the matter of Bartle. Mr. Hand.
May it please the court. On June 11, 2007, the appellee filed a motion to dismiss the underlying bankruptcy proceeding pursuant to 11 U.S.C. 1112, which provides that only after notice and a hearing, a court may dismiss a case for cause. Both parties agree that the concept of a
After notice and an opportunity for a hearing, but as is common in summary judgment proceedings, there's often no evidentiary hearing if there's nothing to show. So the question that has bugged me since reading your briefs is, if there were an evidentiary hearing, what would you show? Your brief doesn't mention what you would show at such a hearing. What would you show?
Correct, Your Honor. What is at issue is the procedural safeguard that was ignored, and the fact that there was absolutely no opportunity.
As I said, you don't get an evidentiary hearing unless there is a dispute about a material fact. The fact that the statute says notice and an opportunity for a hearing doesn't mean that a hearing will be held if there's no material dispute. Now, the question I'm asking is, what in this record is a disputed issue of material fact that would be explored at the hearing?
Well, Your Honor, the question you raise addresses the precise issue, is that there was absolutely no opportunity to be heard to get a factual issue in there.
But is there any plausible basis to think that Mr. Bartle could put together a viable plan and pay his debts to the government? In other words, what might Mr. Bartle have argued to Judge Barker in opposition to the government's motion to dismiss the bankruptcy? Because absent some showing as to what he might have presented, there wasn't any error that in terms of notice and lack of a hearing would be harmless, particularly in a case where you have a judge, Judge Barker, who was well familiar with the underlying facts. And that's my problem as well.
Yes, Your Honor. If an opportunity had been had to have a reasonable opportunity to be heard, Mr. Bartle could have presented evidence regarding the assets to which the appellee actually references the ownership interest in Inverness Health Corporation, with own interest in subsidiary corporations, and additional evidence regarding the value of those interests, not just the interest in Inverness Corporation, but also the value of the interest in the subsidiary corporations. Just because the appellee states that the value of those interest is X does not make it so. Additionally, there could be some, as the appellee recognized previous in this case, in which Judge Barker was familiar, was that the debtor was ordered to pay a fine of $1.3 million and indeed did pay that fine, even though no one thought that he would be able to pay that fine or obtain financing for that. But the underlying issue is that there was absolutely no opportunity to even present a factual issue.
Is it his position that no one from Judge Barker's chambers contacted his counsel to see whether he opposed the motion?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that issue was raised in the appellee's brief, and we did not respond to it because it is, in our view, it wasn't even worth justifying an allegation of an ex parte communication that can only constitute rank hearsay. No one in our office is familiar.
I must say, judges rely on such things all the time, including this court. A motion is filed in this court, staff attorney may call counsel for the other side and say, do you oppose this motion? Do you agree to it? Do you want an opportunity to brief it? This court relies all the time on the answers to that, and the government says in this case that that happened in the district court here, and you chose to ignore it.
Well, I believe
you could, if you want, file an affidavit saying that there was no such call, but that hasn't been done.
I believe there are many ways to go about contradicting the government statement, and the mere existence of filing the motion.
The way that you chose to contradict it in your reply brief was to say, well, there couldn't have been such a call, or we wouldn't have filed a request for reconsideration in the district court, which is a non sequitur. It could have been that there was such a call and the answer as represented, and then you or Bartle changed his mind later.
In theory, yes, that could have been, Your Honor. However, that was not the case. And I believe the statement is actually that there was a...
One would expect an affidavit saying it was not the case, rather than the non sequitur argument, there couldn't have been such a call or we wouldn't have sought reconsideration.
The procedural mechanisms in place to rebut that, you know, that there could be several, and simply because the debtor chose to follow the procedural safeguards specifically set forth in the bankruptcy code and the rules of civil procedure should not be held against him. Now,
I don't think that has anything to do with my question. It's not whether something is held against someone. The question is how one responds in an orderly legal system to a claim that an opportunity was extended and waived orally.
Well, I'm not quite sure the argument of waiver was actually raised. There was an inference that the call was made, and that's why it was dismissed, but there is no argument from the appellee that actually constituted a waiver, and therefore I do not believe that issue is present before the court. Now, that could be a fact, but it was not argued that that was an actual waiver.
Counsel, what we're hearing in many different forms here today and in your briefs is a non-denial denial, which is not an effective denial that the call was made, that the contact was made, and that's the problem here. You're not denying that the call was made. You're raising all kinds of, you know, chaff arguments here.
I can tell you today that we are aware of no call that was made, whether it be an assistant, a paralegal, myself, who is the primary attorney on this case, or any other attorney in our law firm. I cannot deny. All I can simply say is that to the best of my knowledge, there was no such case, nor would there be any reason for such statement to have been made, primarily because the notice that was provided specifically allowed for 20 days in which to present an objection to the motion to dismiss. However, only 10 days intervened between the time that the motion was filed and the order was entered, which is in direct contradiction to the bankruptcy rules of 1017, which states that a bankruptcy court shall not dismiss a case absent notice in a hearing as set forth in Rule 2002, which then requires 20 days notice.
It is true that your motion for reconsideration did not address the merits of the dismissal motion?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So you made no proffer. So the record is essentially, as has been discussed by my colleagues, really it contains no description of what you might have shown at a hearing.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor. And it's because that we filed the motion to alter or amend, and in the issue before that court on the motion to alter or amend was not the underlying issue that should have had a hearing and we should have been presented an opportunity to be heard on the cause as required by 11 U.S.C. Section 1112. The issue before the court on the motion to alter or amend was the procedure an error in entering the order prior to allowing absolutely any opportunity to be heard. I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Hand?
May it please the court. The motion to alter or amend was a sufficient hearing in the circumstances of this case. And for the first time, debtor has suggested in this in this courtroom this morning what evidence he might possibly be able to present that could have made any difference at all in the ultimate outcome in this case. And his suggestion is that maybe Inverness has some kind of value that's yet to be explored. Of course, he didn't make that argument to the district court. And when we argued in the district court that there was absolutely nothing to be presented, they did not reply. But Inverness is in federal receivership, and it's that is a fact. It's not speculation, and its assets are far less than its assets are far less than its liabilities.
Do you know what I found sort of interesting? You allege, of course, that someone from Judge Barker's chambers contacted Mr. Bartle's counsel and ascertained that he did not oppose the government's motion. In my experience, though, when judges learn that a motion is unopposed, they note that fact in their orders. And Judge Barker didn't do that here, did she? She never put the unopposed nature of the motion in writing.
No, you're right, Your Honor. That was not noted in the order. And then the motion to alter followed the order then when it wasn't noted as unopposed. And so then we made the representation, you know, we thought that there had been this conversation, and it was never responded to.
It was never responded to by?
By the debtor. In other words, when we opposed, government opposed the motion to offer them in, which followed the order, and the order did not say, you know, this is an unopposed. The order didn't say that, so then what followed was a motion to alter or amend, and in it we said, well, you know, we thought there had been this conversation. And then there was a 30-day period where the court waited to rule and then ruled. And there, in that 30 days, there was no reply suggesting either that they had you know, some significant evidence to present or anything that could change the outcome of the case. Well, the other thing that he pointed to in his argument as evidence that they could have pointed to or a fact that they could have made was that they came up with $1.3 million, but that just merely transferred, you know, a priority claim from one place to another, and didn't change the outcome, which is that there's approximately $8 million that has to be provided for in any plan of reorganization. If there are no questions, submit on my brief. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Hand?
Yes, Your Honor. I would also like to point out that as the appellee raised, there was no additional evidence presented regarding the underlying for-cause requirement shown. One of the additional reasons for that, the appellee's argument because no evidence was presented, then it should be ruled in their favor. You know, I cannot guarantee that we would be successful in the underlying for cause evidentiary showing, whether that be submitted on briefs or actual evidence presented. But the point is, we are actually entitled to that showing. I mean, one of the reasons is that this case has taken so long because we actually were working with the appellee to liquidate some of the outgoing liabilities, and it was a mere week after the final judgment was entered in that case, an agreed judgment, mind you, that they came in and filed the motion to dismiss. So we had 20 days to figure it out. For that reason, we believe we're entitled to a hearing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under